Pickaxe.
Hello, my friend. My name's Sean, and I want to end your suffering. No, not like that. With meditation in my new podcast, Mindfulness for Gamers. Each episode, I'll take you through how mindfulness can help you to feel less anxious and frustrated and put you on a path of happiness, all through the lovely, grimy lens of video games. So make time to level up your mental health and take the first step on your spiritual skill tree. Join me and subscribe to Mindfulness for Gamers right here, right now.
Hello and welcome back to the Review of Death, a Doctor Who podcast. I'm Matt.
I'm Billy.
And this is your place to be if you want fortnightly updates on Doctor Who news and a review of a particular story of your choosing.
Yeah.
And this week we're talking about the season 15 story, Underworld, with Tom Baker, Louise Jameson and John Leeson.
So quite a departure from the twin dilemma last week or the fortnight before. Irrelevant if you're listening to this a year from now.
Yeah.
We're trying to get used to that vernacular. quite a different kettle of fish. And I'm very eager to kind of get into it and see
what we think about it.
Because I can see that there's a little bit of a...
Yeah, well, I... Well, an idea behind the show sort of forming
at the moment. But news. Let's talk about stuff that has happened.
What's happened?
Not an awful lot. Tony Selby.
Yes.
Yesterday, as a recording this, or was it the day before?
So we are recording this on the...
7th?
8th of September. So 7th of September, yeah, Tony Selby passed away. Mm. We obviously, earlier in the year, had that very weird thing where we thought he'd already passed away. And that was a different Tony Selby working at the BBC around the same sort of time. Couple of months later,
he has actually gone. Not the actual Tony Selby. Yeah. Like the other one's irrelevant. Glitz, Sabon. I think probably one of the best characters to come out of the '80s. I think,
really?
Considering the little screen time he had.
Yes, you know, he's only in two stories. Well, three, I guess, if you count the Ultimate Foe. But yeah, he made a really big impression, and he really fits in well with that whole 1980s glamour of J&T's era, and he was just a really good reoccurring character, and I think he really could have come back multiple times and it would always been like, oh, Glitz is back. It's funny actually, because when I watched Dragonfire recently with the season 24 box set coming out, I sort of thought that it was like, you know, he was only in it the year before, but there is sort of like he's back.
He's clearly got on well with everybody as well. And there's a nice rapport with the production team.
Yeah.
I don't think he works quite as well with Sylve as he did with Colin. Because I think those are two very different characters that they're playing off against each other. But still lovely to have him back. And fits so well into that McCoy aesthetic. Like
very
the look
so.
Of him is great. And yeah, a shame we never really got to see more of him in the program, and he was always a great ambassador for the show, talking about it in behind the scenes features and stuff,
and doing conventions and stuff.
Exactly, he was always like a kind of pleasant face to see pop up, talking about the program.
And I mean, my brother asked me this the other day. He was like, "Did he ever do any Big Finish?" And I said, "No, he didn't." And I don't know if that's because he was never asked, or perhaps he was asked and wasn't interested, or too much money.
Or the rights to Glitz might be a bit funny.
I don't know.
Who knows?
But it was a shame because he would have been really good back on audio.
And you wouldn't have noticed because he sounded exactly the same.
Yeah.
When we heard from him in special features and
he's
stuff.
Just
so, yeah.
Del Boy in space.
Literally.
And it's just...
It works so well.
Yeah.
And I can't imagine anybody else playing that character.
No.
And considering really... This is the only thing I've seen Tony Selby in.
Yeah.
You know, I know he was in EastEnders.
He was in EastEnders
while.
And he's done a few comedy things.
Yeah.
So I think I've seen him in stuff.
But this was my only real exposure to him. And yeah, it made a really genuine impression on the programme. So very, very sorry to see him go.
Yeah.
But there we go. Now, there hasn't been an awful lot of Doctor Who news besides that.
No.
Few things we can talk about, though. Firstly, and we'll talk about it because it's Series 13. News. We understand now that Dan Lewis is a plasterer from Liverpool.
Oh, God. Exciting.
Doesn't get more exciting than that.
Your pants stuff, that is.
What I thought was quite interesting about that interview on BBC Breakfast is the edict that he's called a friend of the Doctor now, not a companion.
I know.
What do you think of that?
I don't like that.
No.
It's been a companion for all this time. Companion. I can understand why they got rid of assistant.
Mm, yeah.
Because assistant does sound fairly... You're playing second fiddle.
I suppose companion has that kind of connotation as well. Like, it seems there's a hierarchy. You're yes. somebody's companion.
Yeah,
do you know what I mean?
I guess so. But I mean,
I prefer the word companion rather than friend, personally. Yeah. But you know,
yeah, because it was like even on the B&M sets, it was the friends of the 13th Doctor set, not even companions of the 13th Doctor.
But you know, everybody's just going to keep using the term companion.
Well, this is the thing. You know? It's so ingrained into the program. Mm. You know, even if it's not really said. Mm. Everyone around it is just part of the lexicon of being a Doctor Who fan. It's a companion. So I don't know why they're bothering, really.
No.
I don't think many people are going to be going, oh, friend.
I don't know why they're bothering, but equally, it's not like the word companion is being phased out.
No.
Everybody's going to keep using it.
Yeah.
It's not a story, basically.
No.
I suppose some people wanted us to talk about the lack of news and what we think about the way the show's being promoted at the moment.
Yeah.
Considering we're, what, maybe a matter of weeks, months
yeah,
away from the show starting.
Yeah.
Autumn sort yeah. of time is going.
I imagine
winter.
It'll be like next month.
Yeah, exactly.
Maybe.
But we don't know.
No.
So we don't know what the lead time is on that stuff. The Find the Doctor stuff seems to have got a bit quieter.
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult because, like we said last week, or last time, that's really good, and I think that's a really clever thing that they're doing, and it's really fun if you have the time to invest in that. And
exactly.
You know, and, you know, probably when I was younger, I might have been more interested, but, you know, I like seeing other people say, oh, this is a thing.
Mm. But the only thing I've actually been able to detect recently was a newsletter that came out, and
yeah.
some letters were italicized and in bold.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, oh, look, that's something to do with that. I haven't got the time to work out what it is. I did
yeah.
write down every letter, but then it was just a jumble of letters on my notes on my phone. And I was like, huh, okay, well, I'll leave somebody else to do that. They can tell me what it means. I guess the thing that a lot of people are frustrated about, though, is that we're not getting a lot of information,
no.
you know. I would say I don't think this is particularly dissimilar in terms of the information we've been given for prior Chibnall seasons.
Oh, no,
it's
not at
all. Just the way that he wants to promote the
yeah.
show. It has led to some genuine surprises.
Yeah.
It's not like it hasn't worked in terms of keeping stuff
oh, yeah.
under wraps. So I'm totally fine with it.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, it'd be nice to get a bit more information every now and again.
Yeah,
but
I was sort of thinking the other day, like, can you imagine if J&T went on to, you know, BBC Breakfast to promote this with a star, a named star like John Bishop, to promote the series, and the only bit of information he could give was he's a plasterer. J&T would have gone mad.
He would
have been
go mental.
What on earth are you doing?
What was it he used to say? Like, watch and find out. Or,
yeah,
you know,
well, yeah.
Stay
yeah,
tuned.
Stay tuned, you know. It was quite funny to hear John Bishop just sort of say, oh, you know, they told me off because I'm from Liverpool. Like, you know, what do they expect?
I loved it.
And he literally said, it's me in
yeah.
Doctor Who.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's like, well, that is everything we need to know about your character. You are John Bishop in Doctor Who.
But it's like with Bradley Walsh.
Yeah.
We weren't expecting any more than that,
yeah.
really. And it's not like we knew any more about him than before. I
no.
mean, it might be that the press photographs had a bit more character in them, like his West Ham badge
yeah.
and that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
But you know what? Dan Lewis, new companion. He's a plasterer from Liverpool.
Yeah.
It's no different to the only information about Mel Bush being she's a computer programmer from Peace Pottage.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Like, so what?
Yeah.
You know, and that's
yeah.
fine. I'm happy with that as a byline. We
yeah.
can learn about him as the series goes
yeah.
on. That's kind of what the show is about.
Yeah.
It's not about giving this backstory for this character before you even met them.
No.
I know everybody wants to know.
Yeah.
But, you know.
Yeah. Someone posted something quite interesting the other day, which was the publicity images of the companion, of the friends, sorry.
Of the,
of the friends of 13th Doctor from series 11, like just before the trailer dropped for that, her first series. And it was the one of like Graham in the chippy and
oh, yeah.
yeah, Ryan's in the calf and
yeah, she's having a pizza at home.
Oh yeah, she's having a pizza on her own. And someone says, like, if you saw these pictures as a member of the public, what on... You would not think it had anything to do with Doctor Who.
I know.
You would
but
just
that,
be like...
But I quite liked that trailer when it came out. I know that people preferred that one to the ceiling...
Oh, I hated the
glass
ceiling
trailer.
It was just, like, so, like... Oh.
That was a bit too on the nose,
it's
maybe.
So on the nose.
But
it was like, come on.
At the same time, it's kind of like, oh, you know... I've relaxed a lot about Doctor Who promotion. You know, we both have.
Yeah, yeah,
let's
yeah.
be fair. I quite like the concept of it, be it that trailer from Series 11 where it's like, well, the Doctor's kind of coming into their lives when they least expect it and kind of making it better
yeah,
or
yeah.
like improving it or whatever. But, you know, she's not Spider-Man. That scene comes across like, you know, or Wonder Woman or Superman doing really fast, or The Flash or whatever. And it's like, she hasn't got superpowers. And then she's this omnipotent, angelic being as she comes out of nothingness and stuff. Yeah. And it's kind of like, I mean, sure, but it's got nothing to do with what we're going to see. Then again, it's not like we saw Chris Eccleston actually being chased by a fireball in series
that
one.
That is true.
So,
but it looked bloody good.
It did look good.
It did get everyone very excited.
Talking about things that Christopher Eccleston might get people excited over.
Oh, yes.
We have got the... Well, no, it's not exciting. He's not going to be in the 60th anniversary special. I have got the full quote that he made during Q&A at Dragon Con in Atlanta, Georgia, just a couple of days ago or a week or so ago. And he was asked by the interviewer if he would please appear in the 60th anniversary, to which he said, "My relationship with the BBC over Doctor Who has not healed. I hope this never happens to you, but at the time of my leaving, I agreed with Russell that I'd go quietly and respectfully and I'll look after the show in terms of publicising it." And then without saying anything to me, they announced I was leaving. It's interesting now we're seeing this stuff. I feel like this is the most candid he's been. I mean, there's a lot more that we...
Oh, God, yeah.
You know, is out there and people know about that hasn't been discussed. I mean, probably shouldn't, really, in this kind of public setting. But he goes on to say, "They didn't tell me they were going to do that. And more importantly, they created a quote and attributed it to me that I was tired. The thing is that I wasn't... I didn't find it too tiring. I found it tiring working with Russell and Phil and Julie. I didn't find it physically too tiring." When they said that, any other producer reading that would say, "I'm not going to employ Christopher Eccleston because he gets tired." So it's a lie. And I'm from Salford. You don't do that to me. They issued a kind of apology, but it's not enough. So no. But I'll do Big Finish and I'll come to these conventions.
No. Well, I mean, it's nice that he's able to, you know, he sort of made his peace with that side of things, but he's found an avenue where he can revisit the character. Because I think this is quite horrible that he got a lot of flack, didn't he, in the years afterwards from certain sections of the fandom saying, "Oh, Christopher Eccleston hates Doctor Who" and all this sort
of stuff. Well, just because he just didn't talk about it.
Because he didn't talk about it. And, you know, obviously we aren't privy to what exactly happened. And obviously, you know, this was a massive thing for him, you know, to be the face of this huge franchise and then... for it to go so badly wrong, you know, and he obviously had a lot of personal things going on at that time as well. Mm. So it is a really, must be a very difficult thing to contend with.
Yeah. Well, it's a trauma.
It is a trauma,
isn't
it? And I think, you know, it's just good now that people can see, actually, he never stopped loving the part.
He just had to find a way back into it in his time.
Yeah. You know, and he always used to say, you know, he used to love the fact that kids enjoyed it and, you know, would write to him and all that sort of stuff, because, you know, it was nothing, something that he never had before, and it was a new experience for him. So I think, yeah, I mean, it's great that he's able to do these Big Finish box sets, because, yeah, I think that sort of makes it clear that he's going to be doing more after this first four which is brilliant. I've just finished listening to the second one. That was really good.
Really good?
Yeah. I thoroughly enjoyed it. Yeah. Okay. Much, much better than the other one.
Yeah.
Because it was just three separate stories. No arcs, no confusing stuff. It was just quite clear.
Good.
And you can just tell that he's having a really good time with it.
I think that it does, to me, and I wasn't of this mindset a fortnight ago, reading that, it's going to take a lot to get a feature out of it in terms of a retrospective in the future.
Oh, yeah.
And I know, you know, we're being, it might sound a bit pigheadish sort of saying this, going like, well, let's think about when we're going to learn more.
We
know as much as he's willing to give us.
Yeah.
And that's obviously taken time for him to get back into the frame of mind to be the Doctor again.
Yeah.
So to then uncover more stuff from the production at the time is obviously going to be a very difficult thing for him to do.
Yeah.
It would be nice to know more.
Oh, yeah, of course.
But, and not in any kind of salacious rubbing our hands like, well, let's find out what really happens, on the day that the pig stuff was shot for the Aliens of London two-parter. But we don't need to know that stuff.
No one's
enjoyment of the programme is going to be changed
not
knowing.
I
think it could by finding out a bit more about all that stuff.
Yeah.
I think a lot of perceptions would shift.
Yeah.
And the fact that he's very clearly mentioning the BBC as a whole.
Yeah.
He's not saying the people that worked at the BBC then, even though he singles out Russell, Julie and Phil.
Yeah.
Just goes to show it's an issue with the corporation.
Mm.
And if they're responsible ultimately for piecing things together for these box sets,
yeah,
when it comes to series one,
Yeah,
I would pretty much count Chris out of talking about it.
Yeah.
Really. And would they want to discuss it without him being there? I doubt it.
That's another thing.
It's not fair.
No.
It's almost like attributing the quote to him, really.
It is, isn't
it? He's not going to be able. He's not going to be fully happy with that unless he's there to say his piece and do his bit.
Yeah, it's very sort of murky waters, that whole situation. I think if we do get to the new series in these collection sets, I would imagine that David Tennant stuff will inevitably come out first. Because it,
just like series 12. We'll get, what, like series 2 or 4 first or something.
Because, you know, David is always there for the series. I think he would gladly come and sit down and do a behind the sofa and watch his series with his father-in-law
Definitely.
And his wife.
Definitely. Or whatever,
you know? Yeah. So I think, yeah, maybe for Eccleston, we'll have to wait a little longer.
Right. Well, that's the news over and done with.
Yeah.
Today, in our review of Death, we're going to talk about Underworld.
Yes.
What were your initial sort of feelings about coming to this story? Because, as we all know, Fourth Doctor.
Yeah,
your
my favourite
Doctor.
Yeah.
I am not a fan of this era, specifically later 70s.
Yeah, me
Tom
neither.
Baker, so sort of Graham Williams.
Yeah.
Anthony Reed sort of era.
Yeah.
What did you make, Matt, of Underworld?
So I went into it. This is one of those stories where whenever I watch it, I always sort of switch off. If I'm having a marathon or something, that one goes on, and then I just find other things to do, and then it's over, and then we're on to the next one, which is Invasion of Time, which is, that's a story for another day, but
I hope so.
Yeah. I went into this one, I thought, you know, I'm going to try and really focus my attention on it and really try to, not necessarily enjoy it, but
sure.
I actually kind of did enjoy it.
Uh-huh.
I think episode one is really quite strong. I think there's a lot of good setup in episode one. Episode two, it goes down fast, very, very quickly. As soon as you get into CSO land with all those terrible tunnels, it's just the story falls apart. And it's not just in terms of the production either. Nothing happens in that episode. They're just running around tunnels. There's no plot.
It's not just part two, though, that happened. That's every part after part one.
Oh, do you reckon? I think it sort of picks up. Episode three and four, I think it picks up ever so slightly.
Do you know what I was really aware of as we were watching it? Is the amount of material that's reused back and forth between the episodes.
Yeah.
And how obviously padded it is.
Yeah.
And that doesn't change.
No.
So to me, in the sequences where there isn't plot happening, which is quite a lot of the time in this story as a whole, not just individual parts.
Yeah.
I'm kind of watching it and going, like, we haven't spoken about the plot for about 5 minutes.
Yeah.
It's literally just been a shot of them going up a thing, a shot of them coming back down the way, you know, and that's it.
Yeah.
Having said it in that manner, though, I have to say, I actually had quite a bit of fun watching it.
Yeah.
I enjoyed it a little bit. You know, like, I'm not going to say that this is like a revelation. Like,
no.
You know, this is like when Enemy of the World turned up and everyone went, oh, it's actually quite good. This is not that.
No.
Is it deserving, though, of being the worst Fourth Doctor, ranked the lowest Fourth Doctor story?
Is it worthy
of all time?
I mean, it definitely probably does need to be up there, doesn't it, really?
Would you not put the... Would you have the Power of Krull over this? Or
quite like Power of Krull.
Armageddon Factor?
Oh, God. Armageddon Factor is deathly dull. Mm-hmm. And it's also written by Bob Baker and Dave
Rebus
Martin.
Operation?
That's quite dull as well, isn't it, actually? But there's some nice bits in it. And it looks quite good. It looks nice, actually.
Yeah.
But I think that's... See, the Rebus Operation looks good.
Whereas this is brown
that's
and
it.
Beige.
Brown and beige. That is the image that conjures into my mind when you think of that story.
The only thing that brings any colour is Tom's scarf.
Yeah.
Is that a new scarf?
That is a new scarf.
Because I noticed he's wearing it slightly differently.
Yeah.
It doesn't sit on him like the other ones do prior.
Yeah, it's wider and I think it's longer and the colours are slightly off.
Mm.
They're not quite the same colours, so it looks a bit weird.
He's basically all scarf on his torso.
Yeah.
Like, at least for previous ones, you have the loop.
Yeah, he doesn't.
Or
he keeps it all bunched up.
Yeah.
I think he wears it first in Image of the Fendal.
Mm.
I could be wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But he definitely wears it in Invasion of Time, and then he never wears it again.
Interesting.
I think
that's it.
Yeah, that's it. He only wears it for those two or three stories.
I have to say, I was looking at the fact that I noticed it looked like a different scarf to me indicates that there's something not quite right about it. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
It was standing out it for some reason.
It also indicates the story is so bad. You know, like, oh my God, that's a different skill.
The knitting pattern looks a bit different on that. And I don't know anything about that sort of side of production. Let's do the quick rundown of sort of bits and bobs that happened around that time. I have to say, it's a very boring time.
Is it?
With the exception that December that's just gone, obviously this story came out in January 1978, is... Star Wars has just come out.
Right, yeah.
And the production were aware at some point, I'm not sure at what point of production, it was probably before the sets were being fabricated and the costumes being made.
Yeah.
That Underworld was going to debut 10 days after Star Wars came out in the UK.
My God.
So, and they're also in a position at this point where they are considering dropping Underworld.
Right.
Entirely.
Yeah.
And reallocating the budget to Invasion of Time.
Yeah.
Because there was a massive economic crisis at this point in the UK. And it destroyed the budgets for the second half of this season. And so that is why you've got quite an impressive spaceship set.
Yeah.
On board the R1C, is it?
Yeah, yeah.
And then it kind of... doesn't really get used again, and then we're all in CSO land for the rest of the story.
Yeah, and it's clever that they use the same set, slightly refabricated.
But it's clearly the set. It's like they just put some coloured gels on the light, so it's all pink and stuff.
UK, very economical.
Yeah, very economical, and they had to be.
Yeah.
UK number one single at this time, Matt. Do you want to have a guess?
Oh, 1978. I don't know.
It was Paul McCartney in Wings.
Was it?
With Mull of Kintyre.
Mull of Kintyre? I don't know.
Mull of Kintyre, oh mist rolling in from the sea. It's a... Scottish people hate it because it's like...
I don't know it.
It's him basically singing about, I love my farm and I love Scotland. I love Kintyre. And all Scottish people are going like, Who's this English bloke who's just moved up into this farm? It's not very well liked, I don't think.
But it was number one.
It was number one for a long time. UK box office number ones at that time. The Gauntlet, directed by and starring Clint Eastwood.
Right.
And of course, Star Wars, which would go on to become the highest grossing movie in the UK in 1978.
Yeah.
Other movies that came out that year, Matt, that are particularly important, think of any 1978.
Oh, 1978.
Or at least ones that might have been kind of in the top five highest grossing movies of the year.
1978.
As if Star Wars wasn't enough
to derail this
production by comparison.
Is it a Bond?
There's no... Moonraker would have been relatively close to this.
Yeah, that might have been 79.
Was it 79?
Oh, might have been. I don't know. I can't remember.
Superman.
Of course, yeah, Superman, yeah.
Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Right, yeah.
Grease and Saturday Night Fever.
Wow.
So big movies. A couple of notable events in terms of British sci-fi as well. So 2nd of January, Blake 7 debuts on UK TV, which is, you know, just under a week before this episode comes out.
Yeah.
Dudley Simpson sneaks in a little Blake 7 thing into the music.
Yeah, I didn't pick that up.
It's when they're heading towards the planet.
Yeah.
I think it's the beginning of part two.
Right.
You can just about hear it. Just buried in the...
There's a little...
There were little... It's like the production info subtitles say it's there, and then you listen to it, and you're like, I mean, there's a little bit of orchestration that sounds very Blake 70, but it is Dudley Simpson,
it's
after
the same
all,
composer,
so it all sounds
it?
Like...
Yeah, exactly. Like, Dudley you can Simpson. Watch Blake 7 and go, oh yeah, this sounds like Doctor Who.
Exactly. And then the 8th of March of that year, Hitchhikers debuts on Radio 4.
Okay.
About a week after Underworld was TX. It's about a month, sorry. A month after part 4 of Underworld went out.
Gosh.
So...
It was a big year, 78.
Big year for stuff. And... Underworld arrives.
And Underworld happens, yeah.
And it's...
I was thinking, the thing with season 15, now I've not watched all of Blake 7 yet. I've watched half of Blake 7.
We should probably talk a bit about Blake 7.
We should probably do it about Blake 7, yeah. And I remember Blake 7 being on from my childhood. I remember watching it on UK Gold either before or after Doctor Who. And obviously very similar in the look of both programmes. But I think season 15... looks very Blake 7-y, or Blake 7-y looks very season 15 Doctor Who. And by that, I mean, I think it looks cheap. I always thought that Blake 7 was meant to be slightly
bigger budget
Doctor Who, but it's quite the opposite. It seems like it's on more of a shoestring budget than Doctor Who ever was. But saying that, yeah, they both look like the same universe. It looks like it's all shared between the same people.
The R1C looks like...
It does, yeah. It looks like Blake and his bloody lot could have come in at
looks,
any moment.
It looks like the Liberator. And it also, does, yeah. We've got a sentient AI controlling the ship, which is very similar to... is it... Who's
Aurak.
Aurak, and then Slave is the second one that's in the Scorpio, I think it's called.
Yeah.
Season 15 is a bit of a weird one for me in terms of actually liking any of the stories in it. Obviously, the horror Fang Rock's great.
Yeah.
Invisible Enemy.
I quite like Invisible Enemy.
It's fine, but, you know, it's not...
It's good fun.
And it's Bob Baker and Dave Martin again, so, you know, they've offered two scripts up. Image of the Fendile, which, you know...
Yeah, I never really understand what is going on in that story, but it's good fun.
And then The Sunmakers.
Not a fan.
No. Then this, and then The Invasion of Time.
Yeah, so it does
so
go
there is a bit of a dip in quality, isn't there?
Now, do you think, having heard what you just said about Underworld almost got the chop, do you think this season would have been better off chopping out Underworld and attributing the budget to Invasion of Time? Because it might have meant we'd have got a better TARDIS interior set... And I mean, we might not have had tinfoil on the coat hangers.
The Vardens were the first thing I thought of that need a bit of a spruce up. I don't know what more you could have done at that time, though. Like, they're obviously trying.
Yeah.
They're clearly trying. Nobody is just resting on their laurels and go, that'll do.
No.
I think we just have to, it's that perspective on TV making back then.
Yeah.
And even now, everyone's trying their best. If it doesn't come out looking amazing, that's usually out of people's hands, and the fact that the budgets were decimated and that when you get to the point in a production where you think we might have to like scrap everything, that is a huge decision to make, because that's a lot of money that you might be you know pissing away. I mean, I can never say that something would be better without something existing.
I
would never want to get rid of any individual story of Doctor Who.
No.
How much could you really have improved the Invasion of Time?
Yeah,
you know, I quite like that story. It's kind of like an early season finale template for what the new series might do.
Very much so.
One thing I would like to talk about straight away, because it was one of the first notes I made, is how good Louise Jameson is.
She's really good in it, isn't she?
I can't remember which story I was watching recently. I think it might have been The Face of Evil.
Yeah.
But I think she's just amazing.
Yeah.
I think she's probably my favourite 70s companion, aside from like Harry and Sarah and Joe. I think she's just exceptional.
She's so good at, and she's so good with the little that she gets to do, because she doesn't get much to do, especially once Graham Williams comes in. I think Philip Hinchcliffe and Bob Holmes had a very clear idea of what they wanted to do with her. And so, you know, she gets much more to do in those first few stories. And I guess Horror Fang Rock as well, she gets more to do, because Fang Rock feels like it's a... almost like a leftover from the previous era.
Yeah, I think there is a lot of that in the early going of season 15.
Yeah.
Even down to the fact, well, this is Anthony Reed's first story where he's totally in charge of it. And you kind of get the impression there's a little bit of an echo of the earlier Tom Baker years, where you're referring to classic literature like Frankenstein or, Phantom of the Opera or whatever.
Yeah.
Here, it's kind of the same thing, but we're going to do myths and legends And I think that's cool, because everybody knows, Jason the Argonauts or the Golden Fleece or whatever. And so it's cool to reference that.
Yeah.
But it does feel like a pale imitation of pale imitations almost that they were doing before.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, nobody's comparing The Brain of Morbius to Frankenstein.
No.
You know, I mean, they're two very different works, but it's the influences of them.
Yeah.
And I think that there is still a hangover of, we're going to be influenced by things.
Yeah.
Nick ideas, repurpose them for Doctor Who. Do you think that this is kind of as far as they can go with that, really? Because I feel like this is the point where they go, let's stop.
I think this is like a step too far, isn't it, almost? So I was thinking that when I was watching it. And there's just not enough going on within the story. You know, the Oracle is just there, and these, like, bumbling sort of henchmen in, like, gimp bloody
costumes. So happy that you got to the BDSM stuff before I did, because I can't look at them and not think, when you take that off, there's a ball gag in their mouth as well.
Johnny said to me, he was like, God, there's one in it who's got a really boring voice.
Oh, yeah.
They're all like it.
They're all the same. Yeah. So we can talk about the villains. So the guards, the seers, and the oracle.
Yeah.
And I have no idea why everybody's so angry at each other.
No, I don't get it either.
Nothing is explained
in this story. This is one of my notes. Was like, things just don't get explained.
No. So we've got Herrick and
Jackson all that lot.
And the crew, Tala, and they're on a ship, and they've lost traces of a ship that went ahead of them that contained
the race bank
of the Minions of Minos. And somehow that has ended up in the hands of the guards.
Well, they are the Minions.
They are the Minions. Yeah. And so the Oracle is sworn to protect the race pods, the banks. Then the Oracle doesn't have them anymore. And then it blows up and then the story finishes.
Yeah.
That's kind of it.
That's it.
It's not that complex a plot. And I think that is the trouble when it's so static. And it's so, like, my brain was leaking out of my ears watching The Twin Dilemma because I found it stupefyingly bad.
Yeah.
This I found boring. Mm. And I know that some people have said, at least there's stuff going on in The Twin Dilemma.
Yeah.
And that this commits more of a cardinal sin by actually being boring and not much happening.
Yeah.
And it was more of a slog to get through.
Yeah.
But I enjoyed watching it more. I didn't feel like as, you know, angry watching it or whatever, you know. Like,
I think the performance, I don't want to say the performances are better because obviously Colin is doing so well in the other one, but obviously the Doctor is written.
Tom hasn't turned up.
Tom is just doing everything that he would normally do. There's some good lines in it as well. There's some funny lines in this story, actually, that I'd never really picked up before. And I thought, actually, in places, the script's quite good, but where the script fails is explaining anything. Like, you know, why is there this weird shift in power? Why is there seers? Why is there slaves? Why do the seers have gold dildo heads? Are they part robot? What are they? That's not really explained.
But as soon as the guards take their gimp masks off, you go, oh.
Yeah.
So they're just blokes in hoods.
Yeah.
And, like, the script is saying, like, the what's it called? Rask is one of them. It's called Rask or something. Grimaces, but it's scripted that he has his hood on, so you can't see anything. It's just like there's maybe it's a similar problem with The Twin Dilemma, that the villain, when they do get introduced, there's nothing going on there.
No,
it's not particularly interesting.
No,
and I don't think it helps as well that Tom is one of his worst performances, I think.
When you get into part two, you can tell Tom is like, I am not enjoying just being stood around on this bloody blue screen. I've got nothing to act off of or against.
Mm.
I'm fed up.
Well, when the cave in happens, in part four, he's just mumbling his lines. He's not acting, really.
No.
He's just sort of, you know, when can we get down the pub, sort of. Or he's already been down the pub and he's sloshed for the entire thing.
Yeah.
Probably just
to get through it.
I don't think it's fair to say that this is the worst Fourth Doctor story. In my opinion, I would prefer this over one or two others.
Yeah, I mean, I'll be honest, I really don't like the Horns of Nymon.
Well, exactly. But I think this is fair to say this is Tom's worst performance.
Yeah, I think he's just like, oh, I can't be arsed.
No.
And I don't blame him, because it must be incredibly difficult, especially for that period of time, to be acting on a blue screen.
Exactly.
For the whole story. You know, the only time he gets any sort of interaction with any props or anything is when he goes into the P7E or whatever.
Mm. There's nothing for him to do.
Yeah.
Like, you know, there's all those stories about him walking into rooms and picking up glasses of water and listening to them. He can't do anything.
No.
And that must be really difficult for any actor.
Yeah.
But also, there is that thing where you just get over it and work with what you've got.
Yeah.
Whereas Tom wears his disapproval of everything going on around him on his face, in his voice, in the way he stands, in the way he looks at people.
Yeah.
There's a clear tension on the recording.
But the performance that really stood out for me, obviously Louise, like we said, was excellent, and you know, she's clearly giving it her all, and she's really good with K-9. She's got a really nice relationship with K-9. She clearly loves the dog, and
I love that bit at the end where she gives him a little smooch. It's lovely.
And you sort of think, oh, if only more of that could have happened, you know. It's a shame that she's leaving in the following story.
Yeah.
It would have been nice to have seen that relationship build. But the performance that really stood out for me was the guy who plays Herrick.
Yeah.
He is really good, and he really gives it his all from part one.
Alan Lake.
He gives it his all throughout the whole thing. He's just so believable. Like, when he's got that little standoff bit on the bridge, and he's like, oh, you go on, I've been waiting to fight someone for all this time. Unfortunately, he gets like shot immediately.
Straight away.
he's like down. I was like, wow, really, that was it? He doesn't kill anyone, he just goes
I love that as well, because it's like, right, we need a scene, like, lasers are popular because Star Wars has done lasers really well. We need a laser scene, and you can tell they've dedicated a bit more time to the lasers.
The
lasers
look pretty good
for
70s Doctor Who. Like, it actually looks better than some of the 80s
I agree.
Laser effects.
I agree.
I was quite surprised.
Yeah.
And I actually think the weapons are quite a clever idea, that it's your shield and your gun all in
one. I was trying to think when I was... I always like to have an emoji for each story when we do the poll. And I was like, I don't know what to do for Underworld. The only thing I think of is a rock, which I did use, or the shield emoji.
Mm.
But... like, how many people are going to remember the shields? No, I know. I just like, I have to put it in though.
Yeah, and even the minions when they put their space helmets on, even they look like very.
I know,
phallic
it's
dildo.
Really weird.
It's like, what?
It's like the design of it is really odd because they all just clash. It's like not one department was talking to another.
Yeah,
now, I know. It might be that they wanted some symbolism to indicate that they were ancestors, from the same sort of, you know, seed bank or the same race or whatever. Yeah. But there are a couple of things that we just think, I know you're trying to get inspired by Star Wars, but the fact you're reusing certain elements in the design is pretty.
It's like, it was almost like they didn't even sort of go down the Greek route either.
No.
It was like, oh, well, you know, maybe we can play up that a little bit in the design.
I think that the space outfits that the R1C crew wear are quite kind of, it's because it's got that golden tinge to it.
Yeah, that's
so
true.
It kind of looks like armor, in a way.
But going back to Herrick,
Alan Lake,
So he's really good. He's in the torture scenes. He really sells it. You know, he does it very, very well. And the moment when he gets the seed banks back, or what he thinks is the race banks. He comes out and he does that bit where he's like, the quest is over.
Yeah.
And he's got this joy, and he always looks like he's lost his mind. But
I thought that they would follow up on that.
Yeah. And he looks so happy. And I was like, wow, he's really going for it. He's really thought about this. And then he passes them to Jackson and he walks off, and you can just see there's just unbridled joy in his eyes. Jackson's got them and he's like, ah, this is nice. And then the guy behind him is smiling as if like, oh, we've gone for a nice day out. And then the woman is like, I would rather be anywhere else than in this shit Doctor Who story.
I know. I think this episode hinges a lot of it on the liking that crew.
Yeah.
And getting in with that crew. And given that, I mean, the guy who played Jackson wasn't dreadful. He was fine.
Yeah,
he was
good.
Doing his sort of like, you know, I'm in charge and I'll lead from the front sort of thing. Tala doesn't really do anything. She's literally there to show that they can regenerate.
Yeah.
And then they never do again.
So no wonder she looked fed up.
Exactly.
At the end.
And then, you've got Alan Lake actually doing quite
He's
a nice
really
job.
Good.
And there's the other guy in it as well, Orff.
Yeah.
Who might as well not be there.
Yeah.
To be honest.
It's a shame, isn't it, really?
You could just give his stuff to Talia. And it would actually make the dynamic of the crew a lot more interesting.
Because
you're not having... But then again, at the same time, it's like, wow, that's another thing you've lost, and you're now everybody's focusing on the set or the CSO or the production of it. And I don't know. You had a story about Alan Lake.
Now, I had a story about Alan Lake. Now, I heard this story ages ago, but he had a really tragic life. So he was married to Diana Dawes.
Mm.
Basically, I think his career just didn't go anywhere, which is a shame because you see him in this story.
Yeah.
And you think, God, he's really good.
I was really surprised when the info text came up and it had like three credits.
Yeah.
One was the Avengers in the 60s. There was another one in the 80s or the 70s.
Right. Yeah.
And this.
Yeah.
And then a couple of like, you know, TV plays or whatever.
Yeah.
But besides that,
It was a much easier, and watching this, you're like, he could have been like a leading man in something. He was really, really good. So it says here, in July 1970, he was involved in a pub brawl for which he was sentenced to 18 months in prison. So that's a good start.
Yeah. And he started acting by this point as well.
He had started acting by this point. And he was sentenced to 18 months. He served a year. He'd hurt his back. He broke his back horse riding and was unable to work. And he became a terrible alcoholic. And then it said, Lake began hallucinating and experiencing psychotic episodes, but was diverted from drinking after becoming a Roman Catholic. And then his wife became pregnant, but then she was advised to have an abortion. But they did go ahead with the pregnancy, but she miscarried. And then he became a heavy drinker again. And then it says he was getting sort of small parts in little bits and pieces, really not much. In the 80s, they separated for a while, then reconciled when he promised to kick all the drinking in. Diana Dawes' health began to deteriorate. She was diagnosed with ovarian cancer.
Yeah.
She died in 1984. He burnt all of her clothes, fell into a depression, and then it says the 5 months after Dawes' death, and 16 years to the day since they had first met, he took their teenage son Jason to the railway station, returned to his Sunningdale home, and took his own life by shooting himself in the mouth in their son's bedroom. He was only 43. He had a really awful life.
That's heavy. That's like all the worst possible things that could happen to somebody happening to them.
Yeah.
That's deep.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, you know what? Wherever you are, Alan Lake, you were bloody excellent in this.
Yeah, you were a
bloody good actor regardless, and you were excellent in this.
Yeah.
Probably the only person besides Louise that's actually given it socks.
Yeah.
So fair play.
Yeah.
Fair play to you. See you in part two.
Hello. This is an advert for the Review of Death Patreon.
It is.
That we're about to start.
So, you know, we've been doing this for a while.
Yeah.
We've migrated into this rather lovely studio space. And we want to dedicate as much time as possible to doing the Review of Death.
Yeah.
We want to spend more time rodding and less time not rodding.
That's good. I like it.
Thank you. So we've decided we're going to open a Patreon, and it is worth saying the Review of Death is going to stay completely free of charge for everybody who wants to just watch the episodes every fortnight or every week when we get around to reviewing Series 13.
Yep.
But for those who would like to support the Review of Death and maybe chuck us a couple of coppers, you'll also get access to some really cool stuff. So we've got two Patreon or patron kind of like tiers that you can choose from, and within each tier you'll get different things. So Matt, tell us a little bit about the people who would like to pay £3 towards the Review of Death.
So if you want to become an official rodder for £3, you will get our eternal gratitude. You will get a warm fuzzy feeling knowing that you're responsible for supporting the Review of Death. You'll also get exclusive behind the scenes content, such as Billy going to the toilet like he just did. I was filming it. He didn't know that, but that's going on Patreon.
Fucking lovely.
Our notes from every show. Well, I say our notes. He's the one who writes bloody essays.
And some screenshots on Matt's phone of his notes.
Yeah. And you will also get a shout out in each episode. So we'll do a little thing where we go, Joe Bloggs, thank you for donating.
Jane Bloggs, thank you for donating. Any other fake names you can think of?
John Smith.
John Smith, thank you very much for donating. Rodder of Rassilon is the other tier, and that's £5 a month. And in that tier, you get everything that you got from the previous tier, but also access to a Review of Death Discord server, which Matt and I will be in. And we'll also do monthly AMAs in that Discord as well. So
what's an AMA, Billy?
It's an Ask Me Anything, Matthew.
Okay.
And basically, yeah, we'll just sort of answer your questions, any burning questions you have about Doctor Who. We'll be there in a sort of town hall type meeting once a month in the Discord server, and we'll have a chat and you guys can sort of weigh in and let us know what you think. So a kind of private, you know, Review of Death mailbag thing just for Discord people, basically.
And of course they will also get early access to episodes where possible.
Exactly. So it's well worth checking it out. If you want to support the Review of Death, we would greatly appreciate it. If not, totally cool. Review of Death is still free of charge for you, but you might get a couple of extra little bits and bobs. And also, you know, ideas of what's coming up in Review of Death, the kind of other things we're going to do within the format. So please check out the Review of Death Patreon and become a rodder today.
Yes. Rod us.
Give us a good old rodding. Welcome back. I think I'm falling out of love with K9.
Really?
And I think this story is partly responsible for that.
Okay.
Because, I mean, I don't know if it's just the cheapness of the show in general. I think it might just be the circumstances it's being made under. But it kind of highlights all of K9's most annoying aspects.
Right.
The fact that he's not very mobile.
No.
The fact that whenever anybody wants to talk to him, they have to get down on their knees.
Yeah.
And his constant bloody whirring. That last scene, which is quite a nice little scene between Leela and the Fourth Doctor, where they're kind of wrapping things up and he says, talking about Jason and the Argonauts and all that kind of stuff. And the whole time you can just hear K9 going, in the background. He has one line of dialogue and then Leela gets down and gives him a peck on the cheek and then it's the closing titles. Could you not have just done his bit separately and not had the ears going?
Yeah, that's true.
Do you know, like, it's just, and also in that first scene on board the TARDIS, something that I became really aware of is the sound of the console and the lights ticking on and off.
Yeah,
I'd never noticed that before.
No,
so, is this just what? Why are we noticing it in this one? I'm sure there's other examples of it in that era. I mean, you can always hear the time rotor going.
Oh yeah, that clunks, isn't it? Yeah.
But the
but that's part of the charm, isn't it?
It is. It is.
Have you seen? Did you watch any of the season 24 studio stuff in the TARDIS?
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
And hearing the scanner open, my God, it's so loud.
It's awful.
It's like the illusion is completely destroyed.
I honestly think that's happened for me with K9 in this story.
Really?
The one thing that really made me laugh is towards the end of the story that there's obviously two different seed pod sets of seed pods.
The race banks. Yeah.
I don't know why I say seed pods, because in my mind I'm just thinking, like, what's in there? Is it just a load of spunk and eggs just in these two things? And they bring those little capsules on board the R1C, which they've taken from the Oracle.
Yeah.
You can see it a mile off that they're bombs or grenades or whatever. So Jackson brings them onto the R1C, puts them inside that little plastic holder, the little display case.
Yeah.
They're there for a little while, and then K9 suddenly gets involved in the conversation somehow. And it's only when he brings them up to his face.
Yeah.
He's like, oh, those are bombs.
Yeah.
It's like, you useless thing. Like, so it's only when people bring things up to you in close proximity that you can be... It's sort of like Marvin knowing the ultimate answer, the ultimate question is the ultimate answer, and people going, why don't you tell us? Or you didn't ask.
Yeah, yeah,
it's like, useless are you?
Yeah.
And he's basically just there to... And I see this through the whole of this season. He's there to get the Doctor and Leela out of prison, basically. He's there to blow out walls.
Yeah, that's very lucky, isn't it? It's just very lucky that he happens to find a bloody Doctor detective.
I know. And he's there with a little quip every now and again.
Yeah.
But I kind of have started, because my mum hates K9.
Oh, really?
And I think she hates him in the same sort of way that people don't like Scrappy-Doo.
Right, okay.
It's just that little know-it-all.
Yeah.
Like, oh, and no one likes a know-it-all. Shut up. Like, you know, sometimes he's funny. And I like John Leeson and I like K9, but in this story...
Really?
I just found him really grating.
Wow.
Really grating. It's not fair to say I've fallen out of love with K9.
Yeah.
But his limitations as a prop and how little they've actually done with him... You know, he's there. He's almost there in the same way as, like, we got a new Sonic because we need to sell the new toy.
Yeah.
You know, he's there as a kind of commercial commodity.
Good merchandise, isn't he? Yeah. Yeah, I can see what you're saying. I mean, I've always, you know, I've seen people say the same sort of thing over the years, that he's a pain, but I don't know. There's a charm to him. I agree.
And I love the fact that the Doctor's got a dog. I think that's really lovely. And I'm not sure K9 would work with any other Doctor.
No.
Only would work with Tom. This is the first story I've watched where I've sort of noticed the things that kind of hold him back as a character.
Yeah.
And where I've kind of been like, I can see why people get annoyed by K9. But that was my hot take. K9 wasn't really doing it for me in the story.
A useless pain in the ass.
He is a useless pain in the ass. Shall we talk about the CSO?
Yeah.
What did you actually think of, because it's always the first thing people bring up is like, oh, that's the episode with the badly green screened caves.
I mean, I think really fair play to them for thinking that they could do it. I mean, I think whoever had the balls to come up with that idea and then follow through with it, well, fair play, because that took some bravery. I think certain bits don't look too bad.
There's a one particular shot near the start,
yeah,
where somebody is running down a little tunnel and then they turn right and go out. When it's lit right and they've got perspective and depth in the lighting, it actually looks quite good.
Yeah.
But as you're getting further and further through the story where they've probably got less time to set up these shots and make sure the lighting is right with the caption slides they've got on the photographic blow-ups of the cave systems, then it's like, oh man, you needed more time to do this. Because when they first start doing it, it doesn't look too bad, but it's just the further you go on, the deeper into the script you get and the story you get, and the less time they've got in the studio to finish those sequences. Yeah. And clearly the more laboured that the actors are getting, going, my God, we have to walk up and down the same stretch of corridor, which we can't even see another nine times.
Yeah.
It also is quite a cheap get out of jail free card for them as well.
Yeah.
You reusing those shots of people walking up and down the caves. Yeah. And that's where this story... You could do this in two parts and it would be quite a nice, tight little two-part run around. It's fine. But it is that running up and down corridors thing.
It really is.
I think it's, you know, the episodes that people consider to be the worst, one of the things I've noticed between this and The Twin Dilemma is that they exemplify all of Doctor Who's sort of stereotypical, the stuff that people would use to kind of, the stick they used to beat Doctor Who over the head with.
Yeah.
They always typify bad monster, crap looking design, running up and down corridors, lots of padding, lots of technobabble.
Yeah.
That's kind of...
It's that in a nutshell, isn't it, really, this story? It's a shame. And it's sad with all the CSO stuff, because other bits of the production actually look pretty good. Like the P7E set and all that looks really quite impressive. Mm-hmm. You know, it's on two levels. You've got the bit of CSO around the front with the, you know, looking out into space and all that stuff. That looks really good. All of the model stuff actually excellent.
It's actually really impressive.
Really love the model stuff.
I think everybody just goes, well, it's the one with the bad CSO, so everything must look bad in this story. It actually doesn't.
No.
The model stuff does look really cool.
You know, all that stuff with the, when all the rocks are starting to form around the ship, that looks really good.
Yeah.
When it crashes, that looks great. Mm-hmm. And the explosion at the end when the planet blows up, that's really bloody good. I was watching it and I thought, God, that's really quite impressive.
Yeah.
And it's a shame that it's sort of sandwiched with, you know, you've got like this beautiful bread, but you've got shit in the middle of your sandwich.
it's a shame. And I think the one of the big problems with the CSO in the story is that you utterly lose the geography
of
locations.
You have no idea where anything is.
So when a chase is happening,
it's
like, well, I don't know how far away they are from each other.
No.
And sometimes they're, you know, Tom is talking in full booming voice. And you think, well, they just round the corner, sure, and you're in a cave, so surely the sound's going to carry.
Yeah.
And because I guess it's difficult to picture it yourself when you're acting, it's even harder when you haven't got somebody who's clearly signposting this caption card leads to that caption card, which then leads back to the ship. There's none of that.
No.
It's just generic corridor. We've had that shot where they go right to left, so now we need to turn the cameras around. You can be quite economical with it and reuse those shots like they clearly do.
Yeah.
But I think that is the problem, is just how overly padded this story is.
Yeah.
It's a real example, a really clear example of how editing can make or break a story when you've not got enough material. The reprise is in it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So one of them's up to two minutes long.
Yeah.
And it's like a 22-minute story.
Yeah.
And then you think another quarter of it is zero dialogue. There are so many long sections where Dudley isn't even writing music for it, where people are just standing around.
Yeah.
And, you know, characters walk from one side of the room to the other. There's that bit, I think, where they capture the Fourth Doctor and Leela and Herrick or Jackson initially, and they're on that kind of bridge.
That rope
bridge.
Yeah.
And then it's like, okay, take us to your leader sort of thing. They walk out of shot, cut. No. We're going to see four more guards walk past the camera because we need to make the time up.
Yeah.
And it doesn't make for pleasant viewing, does it?
No. And it was interesting because I watched bits of it with the info text on, and that whole sequence where they are sacrificing Edas's father and it's like a big ceremony and stuff, it said in the info text, it was like, well, this was added in by the director, all of the responses and stuff. This sort of like almost quite Catholic sort of ceremony.
It's a kind of call and repeat sort of thing.
They said they did that because they just thought, well, there's nothing going on. It needed something. And thank God they did, because that makes it at least give it some sort of an atmosphere. It's a story that just, it plants the seeds of ideas. Like the whole thing about, oh, the Time Lords gave the minions
That's
all this technology,
cool.
And then they had a big war, and the Time Lords were like, shit, we better never do this again. That's really great, but that's never explored at
all.
Well,
I was thinking about that. I was like, so this surely is part of their non-intervention policy
that
ties in with Genesis.
Yeah.
So why wasn't this on the Road to the Dark Times Blu-ray set for Time Lord Victorious?
Well,
come on! Well, because it's Underworld. But I really liked that aspect of the story.
Yeah.
And it was frustrating as well, though, that they've done quite a lot of legwork to set up Time Lord involvement in their history.
Yeah.
They show the regeneration once, and it's a gimmick that's never used again.
No.
You think, well, could you not have had a scene where Herrick is like mortally wounded during his torture, and they bring him in, they've got to get him on the thing, or the doctor gets mortally wounded and they think, well, it's Time Lord technology, it will work on him. And you could have even used that to go like, well, we've messed up his regeneration cycle, so the 13 thing doesn't matter anymore, you know, whatever. You're right about planting seeds.
Yeah, and when they're talking about, when the doctor's talking to Edas, and he's like, oh, this is the tree and blah, blah, blah. Oh no, there are dragons. What dragons?
I know.
What the hell? Like,
and there's a little bit where it's like
that little weird camera thing.
Exactly.
Is that like a laser thing? I don't know.
And that thing where they go, he's never seen what a tree looks like.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, cool.
That's a good,
a bit more on that. Yeah, no, it doesn't really happen.
And even the fact when, you know, that he's getting all the slaves into the ship, and Jackson's like, what are you doing? Get them out, get them out. And he's like, come on, Jackson, these are your people. And you're like, that's really good. But nothing really comes of it. It's like Jackson doesn't have this moment of like, my God,
you're right. What am I doing?
Yeah, you know, it's just sort of like tough shit.
I know.
Leave this planet.
He doesn't come round to it.
No.
Now, because we know that Bob Baker and Dave Martin have alluded to things in the past in their scripts.
Yeah.
Did you get any impression that they were trying to say something about refugees in that little sequence? I don't know if it's just because it's particularly prevalent because of the awful things that have been going on in Afghanistan with the Taliban and stuff.
No, that didn't cross my mind.
I just thought the bit where Tom is going at him and saying, these are your people. It's like, I thought, watching it, I took away from that, you've got to take responsibility for your fellow human beings.
Yeah,
if somebody's in a really bad situation, you've got to help out, you've got to do your bit. I don't know if that's just because of the awful stuff that's been happening in Afghanistan, but I just looked at it and thought, I can see you could maybe read into it that they're trying to say something about refugees and people fleeing wars and all that kind of stuff, because they've got nowhere to go. And I think especially because they're dressed in rags, they're referred to as, you know, sort
slaves,
of slaves. Yeah. And then the lovely bit, which Tom, I thought he'd done it himself, and it turned out he did. The stuff where he's ushering people along, and he picks up that child.
Did he do that himself?
And, yeah,
that
and he makes sure, and he picks up the child, brings the child through the group.
Yeah,
pops the kid down. The first thing he says is, "You look after this child."
Yeah, yeah.
And then he starts dealing with everybody else.
Yeah.
I thought that was a really lovely little moment.
Yeah,
there are lots of nice moments. I it was interesting watching it for the first time in a long time, because you think there's bits in this that actually look all right.
Mm.
Why don't we see these in like clips or compilations?
Yeah.
And because like that last scene on the TARDIS with the Doctor and Leela, utterly ruined by K-9's ears whirring away in the background. A lot of part one looks great.
Yeah.
The model stuff, again, as you said, looks fantastic. And, you know, when the Seers reveal themselves, that's a really cool moment.
Yeah.
It just doesn't mean anything.
No.
There's no weight to it.
And then there's something else, the pacification ray in part one.
And never used again. That's very Douglas Adams.
Why
as
does
well,
no one say, hang on a minute, we've got these very angry gimp men chasing us around. Why don't we use the pacification ray on them?
It just disappears.
And they can just have their gimpy orgy and, you know, we can just get on with it.
I don't know if this is intentionally funny or not either, but I'm just going to read a little bit of the script for you. So
this is
when the Oracle figures out that the vision grenades
are
there. Get rid of them. Guard. There's no time. Then defuse them. How?
Yeah.
And then the scene ends. Yeah. You never see him again. And then the planet blows up.
But I think it's the guy's performance. This is the guy that Johnny was talking about. Just so.
Yeah. It's the same guy.
Yeah, he's just, oh.
But he's like, panic. I love that bit. I thought, I really hope that was intentional to just do this, have this little light relief in it.
Yeah. And I think even the bit when Tom's got them and he's like, oh, they're bombs. And he's like, oh, you know, they're like going to blow up the planet. And he's like, what are we going to do? Well, I think you should probably get rid of them. It's really well done. And like, even that, I mean, it's dopey, but even that stuff when the guard catches them.
Yeah.
And he's like, ah, oh, we've got you, Doctor. And he's like, oh, I don't think you want those. And he's like, those are grenades. He's like, you can do better than that. And it's like, it's so dopey. Mm. But I think you've got through this story so far, you might as well just go, ah, why not?
I do think that there is more of that. There's a bit more levity.
Yes.
As you get further into it.
Yeah.
It's quite worthy at the start.
Yeah.
And then, you know, once you get through all the padding and, you know, somebody could do a really good cut down of this story.
Yeah. Oh god, you could basically cut out episode 2 entirely.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
it would mean so much better.
Exactly.
It would be so much better.
Yeah. I don't know really what we can say about it besides the fact that are you getting callbacks watching The Face of Evil as well to this with like it's Leela's penultimate story.
Yeah.
It's another AI gone mad.
Yeah, that's
sort
the thing.
Of thing.
I did
Votan, Boss, Soan and Oracle. They're all in the same sort of camp.
This was the problem. I was watching it and I was thinking, oh, it's another mad computer. And unfortunately for this one, it's not very interesting.
No.
We've had a computer with schizophrenia in the previous season, which was far more interesting and scary. You know, that end of episode 3 when...
But it's got a gimmick, though.
Yeah.
It's not just like a load of lights.
Yeah.
Like at least... Boss,
yes,
has a cool look.
It has a cool look, and it's very well acted and very well written.
Charismatic,
yes.
A great idea. Votan, you know, it's the first kind of AI, they're kind of building blocks that are the monsters that follow.
And it canonized Doctor Who as the Doctor's name,
exactly. So,
you know, so you got given that.
It's got its place in history. And then other sort of AI things. I mean, what else is there really? I mean, there's.
Like
The Wire.
The Wire
from
Idiot's
Lantern.
She's not AI though, is she? She's just like someone's.
But it's that same
sort of thing.
Stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, we really have mad computers in new Doctor Who.
Not many, I guess. There's like been malfunctions, like yeah, malfunctions. So like the clockwork robots.
Oh yeah,
and the ship just making do. But the ship isn't the villain.
No,
you know, like the ship might be booby trapped in some situations, or like oh that's an eye inside the camera or whatever.
Yeah, there's no sentience to these things.
There's
whereas obviously in
back
these
and forth.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can't have a chat with them.
Yeah, I've got Tom's in a mood or drunk or both.
Yeah,
probably both. I didn't get time to watch the studio footage because he goes mental in some of those ones, doesn't he?
Oh, does he?
I think there's some bits like, well, there's always that, well, let's get on with a bloody stroke when they're doing Leisure Hive.
Yeah,
there's the one where he starts yelling at people when he's in the prison cell with Duggan and Leela for City of Death. Romana, sorry, for City of Death. And then I'm sure there's some stuff on this where I've seen him on blue screen and he's moaning at people or shouting.
I'm not surprised.
No.
I'm not surprised given the circumstances. One thing that I didn't know, haven't mentioned, but it made me laugh was during that sacrifice bit, the guard with the really good acting says of the slaves, they are full of fear. And then it cuts to the extras who look not terrified, but just fed up that they've been standing around all evening waiting to film this story. And I think that's just a story in a nutshell. It's
I love
just
it.
People hanging about. People hanging
not
about.
Not doing much.
Not doing anything.
What do we think of the cliffhangers as well? Probably worth mentioning. I mean, it's a classic kind of era for cliffhangers. We've got one of the best underrated of all time coming up in the next story.
Yes. Yeah, very much so. Episode 1, it frustrated me because that is actually quite a good cliffhanger, but the way it's shot, it's very static.
Yeah.
And the tension just isn't there when they're like, oh, you know.
Well, it's because they're sat around for ages while the rock thing is happening.
Yeah.
And you're not actually getting any kind of
impression. There's no shaking.
No, everyone's just there looking at the screen going, oh, we can't see anything anymore.
Tom and Leela are on that sofa just sat there. Herrick is there pressing buttons, I think. And yeah, it's just all static.
Yeah.
And you think, no, shake the camera. You know, these rocks are like flying at the thing, you know, do something.
Did you have any notes about the director? Because I have got, I know who's done this one.
Norman
Stewart, who was formerly a production assistant on The Daleks, Planet of Giants, The Web Planet, The Savages, The Underwater Menace, Day of the Daleks, and The Invisible Enemy.
Okay.
And he would then go on to direct The Power of Kroll.
Right,
the next year. So, I mean, it's not as static as Peter Moffat.
No.
In The Twin Dilemma.
Not at all.
And actually, there are quite a nice couple of shots, even in the green screen.
Yeah.
There's like a nice bit where Tom and Leela, Tom and Louise, and I can't remember who the other character is that's with them. It might be one of the slaves. They kind of come into shot and it's like shot down a line.
Oh, yeah.
And they're trying to get the camera in the space. Yeah. Not just sort of like shoot it flat as a wide and have like six characters run in and mill around.
Yeah.
And having physical props in there is actually quite a nice thing as well. The carts being pushed around.
It helps, doesn't it? Helps give it...
It sells it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a really nice shot actually in part one where the camera is in the TARDIS and it sort of... The camera sort of moves into the console and it's just like... It just looks like a shot that we haven't really seen before, because I know Tom always used to moan, didn't he, about... Oh, these shots are all the same. He said, won't you do this or do that? You know, because it's just, you know, I know exactly where I'm looking for the bloody camera. Mm. And I think this was one of those moments where there was a bit of thought put into it. I think really it's a shame for this poor guy, because it was a bloody baptism by fire to do your first Doctor
Absolutely.
Who and
they probably,
it's all on blue screen.
They probably gave him Power of Kroll to go like, sorry, we couldn't do like a proper one.
Yeah,
here's a proper one.
Yeah, and I guess that's, you know, got a bit of location as well, you know, so he... Yeah, you managed to get something.
You just have to deal with all these extras not being able to wash green paint off of them and having to turn work down the next day because they turn up to the set.
Covered in green.
They'd love it.
I think it's, as a story, it's not as bad as some people say it is. Because I think we did get quite a few remarks on Twitter that it was
awful. I don't think it deserves to be within... sort of 10 or 20 places of The Twin Dilemma.
No.
I'm amazed it's as far down the bottom as it is.
And I was shocked, actually, that The Rings of Akkar 10 was...
that low as well.
That low. Mm. Because, you know, it's just all right.
Yeah, and it has got a great moment. Like, you can't think of a lot of the stories that are that far down the list don't have standout moments that people still sort of remark upon. But, like, Rings of Akkar 10 has the 11th Doctor's speech and actually... I quite like that story. I don't really have any problems with it.
Yeah.
I know that a lot of people didn't like it when it first came out, and there were a kind of small number of people that were like, actually, it was fine.
Yeah.
And it would have been nice to revisit that. But unfortunately, everybody's decided to make us watch The Space Pirates for episode 3. Thank you very much. I think what we might have to do is we'll do The Space Pirates for episode 3.
Yeah.
And then I think we'll give ourselves a break. And
I was going to say
do a nice one.
After the recording of this, I was like, I must say to Billy, why don't we do something else?
Let's do something a bit different. Yeah. So we'll try and work out what that is. But yeah, the next time you'll see us, we're going to be doing
The Space Pirates.
And we've got a little thing here. I picked my Rodder of the Week. This is somebody who got in touch with us on Twitter, at Dial Confession. Of Underworld, they say. It's obviously infamous for its awful effects, but it's got some great model work, which goes underappreciated. I'm glad somebody's mentioned that,
because it really
is quite strong. The story itself is incredibly bland, though. The BTS doco showcasing how they had to piece it together with no money left is way more interesting than the episode itself. And, you know, it's true. I think that's the thing to take away from the story, is that it is incredibly ambitious.
Yes.
It is massively handicapped by having just... you know, come out around the same time as Star Wars.
Yeah.
That's a problem, because everybody's going to be comparing everything else to Star Wars.
Of course.
Even the bloody Bond producers were like, well, we need to do that now.
Yeah, that's it, isn't it?
So I would give Underworld a go.
Like,
just be prepared for, if you want to fast forward through a lot of part 2 or a lot of part 3 or a lot of part 4, you won't miss an awful lot. But it's fine. And there's some nice things in there to kind of take away from it. I really don't think it deserves to be this far down on the list.
I think that's you saying that about if you just want to forward on. I was just thinking back to my earlier statement of it being a story where I would watch the first episode and then sort of just go off and do anything else and then sort of tune into the end. And I thought, oh, I must find out what I've been missing all these years. And it turns out I've not been missing
much at all. It isn't great, but part one is quite strong.
Part one is a strong start.
And if it followed that same level of quality, or that, you know, things had actually been happening,
yeah,
I think it could have been quite good.
Yeah. But I wonder how much of that is because of the budget, though. I wonder how much of it was because, oh, well, we can't afford to do that, right, so we'll just chop it.
Well,
or
I know that
was the script just...
Even though the budget was a massive concern of theirs, I think the set for the spaceship still came in over budget.
Really? Wow.
I think they still spent too much money on it, which is why there is so much CSO, because they couldn't have built other sets.
No.
But, like, even some of the corridor stuff is quite nice.
Yeah.
Like, you know, just move those big data banks to the other side and you've got a whole new corridor to use.
Yeah.
Doctor Who's very good at that stuff.
Yeah.
Like, sometimes it is noticeable.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's noticeable, but it doesn't need to be something you pull attention to. No. It's a spaceship. All the corridors are going to look the same, you know.
They look the same as Star Wars. No one ever moans about that.
Exactly. And I think actually the colour palette of the beige and the white, that one corridor in particular where there's kind of like a curved section of the corridor.
I
did look at it and think, I can see where Star Wars has influenced them in the set here and in the design. But I really wouldn't put that much kind of credence on Star Wars coming out around time. I think this story always would have struggled because of the budgets.
Yeah.
It just so happens that, it's come out at a really unfortunate time for that story in particular. Yeah. But watch part one and give it a go, because there's stuff to like there. And the like you say, the model stuff's really good. Louise Jameson's fantastic. Tom's baseline as not being, you know, particularly into the story is still pretty
he's still good. When the script requires him to do something of note, he does it incredibly well.
Because all the attention's on him.
Yeah.
You know, there is an element to it,
you
know, of selfishness, maybe.
Yeah.
But it's fine.
Yeah.
Give it a go.
And it's got a bridge with a sofa on it.
It's got a bridge with a sofa on it.
Which is very weird for a spaceship.
It's very, very Blake 7.
Yeah.
Give Blake 7 a go as well. That's another recommendation I think I'd give everybody. Because I was looking at Alan Lake and I thought, he'd be quite a good Blake.
He would have been a good Blake.
And he's got the look.
Yeah.
He looks quite eerily similar.
Yeah.
So give it a go.
Yeah.
Gareth Thomas, eat your heart out. Wasn't it Gareth Thomas?
It was, yeah.
Yeah, so there we go. That's Underworld.
Space Pirates next.
Space Pirates next. And then after that...
I cannot believe that this story was voted lower on that big list than the Space Pirates. Christ, only one episode exists and that makes you want to go into a coma.
We've got to watch a story with basically no telesnaps that exist of it.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, sometimes the watching a telesnap reconstruction can be a slog.
Mm.
But watching a telesnap reconstruction when there are no telesnaps to use in the reconstruction is going to be especially difficult.
Yeah.
I want
this on record that I actually did... I saw the tweet go out because I saw that before you tweeted it that it was Space Pirates was coming up. And I thought to myself, oh, I must say to Billy, maybe we don't do the Space Pirates due to the nature of the existing episode situation.
So I think let's get this out of the way. I think this will be the most difficult one for us to review.
Yes.
I think it will. And I think it'll be a really interesting to see how we approach talking about it.
Yeah. Have you ever watched The Space Pirates?
Once. All the way through.
All the way through. Okay. Yeah. Same.
Yeah.
I can't really remember it. So...
It's six parts.
It's six episodes. Yeah,
oh my God. Well, we'll see you then.
If we haven't died.
Bye.